and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. So go over to your computer and open up a web page. This is something we all do many, many, many times a day, to the point where it just feels mundane because it's easy to do and it's just part of our lives. But when you do that, you're transported to a world of information that, think about it, just a few years ago was a lot harder to access. All that information, the statistics and data and narratives that you come across, they help us guide our lives right now. They tell us about our neighborhoods and cities, about the way that we are interacting with each other. And of course, it notifies us of immediate threats to our well-being. Think about the things that you learn on the internet that make you make immediate decisions about what to do or not to do. Now, for more than 2 years, our largest concern has been this virus that caused a global pandemic. And if you have been quickly able to know when, where, and how that virus is moving, if you have immediate access to the internet, you were probably safer over that last 2 years and better prepared. As more and more of us log onto the internet each day, as almost all of us end up with access to that internet, even in our pockets on these phones that we have, it's getting harder and harder to imagine a world without it. And that leaves real questions about what the government should be doing to ensure that everybody does have that immediate, equitable access to broadband internet. That's where we want to begin the conversation today. How crucial is it that you be able to have this immediate and all-the-time access to this information? And because of the things that happened over the last 2 years during this pandemic, should we be more concerned that there are still people who are disconnected from that, cut off from it by poverty and isolation? To talk more with us about this is Vox journalist Karen Landman. Her recent piece is called "The Surprising Link Between COVID-19 Deaths and Internet Access: The Case for Treating Internet Access as a Health Necessity." Karen, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Your piece is based on a medical study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it ties the link between COVID deaths and internet access. I want to start with you spending just a little time telling us what that study actually says.
Yeah, so this is a study that was actually done at the University of Chicago, and they were basically trying to figure out what it was that caused high rates of COVID deaths in communities where there was one racial or ethnic majority. So they selected counties that had a racial and ethnic majority and that had high rates of death. And then they looked for things that that predicted or that were associated with, I should be very careful there, for factors that were associated with high rates of death in those communities. Internet access was just one of many, many factors that they looked at, but it was the only one that stood out as an associated factor in rural, urban, and suburban places. And it was a pretty robust finding as a factor that was associated with high rates of death in all of those types of communities. And that was surprising for a couple of reasons. The most important one of which is that, you know, we kind of think of internet access as a rural problem, as one that is primarily an infrastructure problem. And this showed that it really is not purely an infrastructure problem. It's not just a matter of, you know, burying the right cables in the right places to get access for folks in a way that matters to their health. Internet matters to folks' health, even in urban places where, you know, geographic proximity and access to information may, you know, may be less of an issue than they are in rural spaces. And this is really, I think, one of the most important findings of their studies, that it's also an affordability problem in urban places.
Yeah. So I want to take a minute to just note one thing that you said there, which is that we got to be really careful about the difference between correlation and causation. I mean, that's a really important thing to keep in mind. But I also want to point out what I hear you saying, I think, is that even given that variable and taking that into account, there is a really strong relationship, or there has been over the last 2 years, between this access to broadband internet and lower rates of COVID. Is that right? Did I hear that right?
You're absolutely right. So, you know, it's not new for us to know that people who have lower income, who are older, and you know, have lower educational opportunities, lower professional mobility, that those folks are less likely to have broadband internet for a variety of reasons. They may not necessarily feel they need it. Sometimes, you know, some older folks may not really feel comfortable online. Not all, for sure. But then there are affordability issues, and then there are, there are other kind of problems with people not having the skills to navigate the internet or use it to their advantage. So not having it in their homes for a variety of reasons. You know, and a lot of those same factors we know are also associated with higher risk for getting disease from COVID. And so, you know, I think for a long time, for the earlier part of the pandemic, it would have maybe been kind of easy to say low internet access is a symptom of the same problems that are causing poor health in these populations to begin with, right? So it's not a cause of poor health. And I think that was kind of a prevailing way of thinking about internet access prior to the pandemic as well, that was really more a symptom of all of these other social determinants of health rather than its own social determinant of health. Now, what the pandemic really showed us before the study was even done, that when life moves online, you really need the internet in order to, like you said, get good information. For example, you know, help you get the kind of information you need to trust and find a vaccine, to trust and find testing. But it also allows you to do the kind of work that keeps you from having to have contact with other people. So, you know, people who have jobs they can do from home have good internet access to allow them to do those jobs. So we found any of us who were in a community of folks who had sort of mixed opportunity saw that the people who had internet access had lower risk. It just seemed innately to make sense. And what this study did was it allowed researchers to actually control for those other things, those other factors, low income, low educational opportunities, and some of these other factors, to really show that even in homes where that was controlled for, internet made a difference. So that really confirmed what a lot of us were becoming very suspicious of earlier in the pandemic, that internet had its own sort of power in this dynamic.
Yeah. I'm talking with Karen Landman. She's a journalist, epidemiologist, and physician who covers health and medicine for Vox. And her recent piece is titled "The Surprising Link Between COVID-19 Deaths and Internet Access: The Case for Treating Internet Access as a Health Necessity." We're talking about all of the things that we've learned about the critical nature of internet access, especially over the last 2 years as we have been trying to survive and manage this pandemic. We would love to hear from you during this conversation as well. Give us a call and tell us how you have used the internet during the height of the pandemic. Do you feel like it helped keep you protected from COVID-19? Did it connect you to resources like vaccine appointments or other medical necessities that you needed? Did you send articles to friends and family members so they could share in the information that you thought was keeping you safe. Also, how do you consider the internet more broadly in terms of how crucial it is? Think of all of the things that we're doing right now with the internet that we weren't doing as much before. How many of us are able to work, for instance, from home instead of going into an office, something that was really necessary at the height of the pandemic? Of course, it's continuing now in many cases because people are just more comfortable working that way. But can you imagine if you didn't have internet access and particularly broadband internet access, which makes all of this really possible? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page and put comments there, or you can go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you in the conversation that way. Also, give us a call and answer a really simple question. Should we be treating internet access the way we treat other utilities like water, electricity, all of these things that we think of as non-negotiables in our lives? Should broadband internet get that same kind of consideration and distinction in our country? Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. You can also go to social media, of course, and put comments there, and we can include you in the program that way. Karen, I want to put that question to you that I just asked the listeners. What's the case for the internet being provided for everyone, and broadband in particular, being treated as essentially as a public good?
Yeah, so I think, you know, this study and some of the other things that we have learned about internet over the course of the last few years really show that internet access is strongly associated with health. And it has been for a long time, and this has just been an opportunity for us to show that or for us to see that in an experimental setting. There are a lot of utilities that are provided, owned publicly, owned by governments, and sometimes in co-ops, and provided through city infrastructure and serviced by cities in a way that is very different from the way that for-profit internet service providers provide internet. And that there is a movement, I don't know if movement is exactly the right word for it, but there is a movement to provide internet as a public utility through municipal or community networks that are run by cities throughout the country. And I spoke with somebody who works on developing these kinds of networks in cities. And he said that it is a lot less complicated than cities sometimes think it will be to create and manage these kinds of networks. Hmm. And they're incentivized really differently than for-profit internet service providers are. And the service that residents receive when they have internet issues and they're using a municipal service provider, the service they get is very, very different from what you get when you call, a national service provider. So there's a pretty good argument in many cases for treating internet as a public utility rather than something that is provided in the places and to the folks where the highest profit is most likely.
Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Call and tell us what you think of how critical, how crucial the internet is and was over the length of the pandemic. Let us know if you think internet access should be treated like electricity or water, other kinds of public goods. Karen, let's talk about how deeply unequal the U.S. is right now in terms of internet access. I think in places like the city of Detroit, we're aware of how difficult it is for poor people to get access and have consistent access to broadband. But how big is the have-nots group here in our country, and Who are they, and where do they live in our nation?
Yeah, so great questions, and probably the best source of information for this these data are the Pew Research Center. They have been gathering data on internet use and in a variety of different groups since the year 2000. So they have a very wide array of different ways to slice these data and look at who has access and who doesn't. And, you know, looking at their latest data from the year 2021, the folks who have higher access to the internet tend to be younger. So they tend to be, you know, ages 18 to 29, and actually, you know, up to the age of 49, access lately has been pretty similar. They tend to be whiter. Lately, you know, that has narrowed as well. And in fact, in the last years of data, access among Hispanic and Latinx communities has been a little bit higher than among white Americans. Gender is about, you know, access by gender is about the same. Income still plays a role. Since the year 2000, access has been higher for folks who have higher incomes, and that disparity remains. Access by education level also remains. I think the last year of data they have for that is 2019, but even then, you know, access was quite a bit lower for folks who had less than a high school diploma. They, about 71% of folks with a high school diploma had access, while about 98% of folks with a college degree had access. And then, you know, the type of community you live in, whether urban, suburban, or rural, also made a pretty big difference, although that difference has also been narrowing over the years. Most recently, 90% of folks in rural areas and about 95% of folks in urban areas had internet access. And we're talking here about broadband internet access, which itself raises an important point. We can talk about that in a minute.
Yeah. Big Neo on Twitter says, the internet is incredibly important. Almost everything now has a portion of internet activity connected to it. The only way to ensure everyone has access would be to treat it like a public utility, so everyone has access. The capitalists won't like that. That's a really interesting point about the way we think about internet access right now. What needs to change, I guess, about how we think this through in order to make sure that it is possible to get everyone access?
Well, you know, I'm sure your readers are familiar with the concept of real estate, or your listeners, sorry, are familiar with the concept of real estate redlining, right? The idea that that rules were made to exclude people on the basis of race and ethnicity from certain neighborhoods, and that as a consequence of that, there has been generational loss of opportunity and wealth. And there's a similar concept of digital redlining, that internet infrastructure has not been placed in the places where there is less of an opportunity to make a profit, often on the basis of income, which, as we know, is often tied with race and ethnicity in this country. And as a consequence, the people who live in the neighborhoods where there's less internet access have less opportunity. You know, in a home where you have limited broadband internet access, for example. So let's say, you know, a couple people in the house have smartphones. A kid may be able to do a partial day of school from that home, right? Mm-hmm. But an adult cannot simultaneously work in that home. And let's say even if they have dial-up internet access, that might be enough for one person to do one thing. But not for everybody in the home to do all the things that would help them generate opportunity for their family, whether it is do well in school, you know, perform at a telecommuting job, and, you know, get groceries in a safe way during a pandemic, get information access. Doing all of those things simultaneously requires a broadband internet connection. And if it hasn't been put in your community because it wasn't profitable to put it there, then yeah, you're going to have less opportunity, and not just to stay healthy, but to build future opportunity. So the redlining concept really lends itself well to understanding some of the dynamics underpinning the lack of internet access in a lot of urban areas as well. And it is profit driven. These companies, the internet service providers that, you know, that many of us are familiar with, it's really up to them to provide, to put internet cables where they want to. And yes, they are subject to restrictions in some states based on how some of the other public utilities run things. In some places, there's a pretty high fee for putting cables on poles that belong to other public utilities, and that has been cited as a big restriction. And some of the solutions to this have sort of been not really sustainable, like a lot of the subsidies for internet access, either, you know, in rural or in urban areas, have tried to reduce the cost, but they all basically require buttressing these for-profit internet service providers, which doesn't really change their incentive structure and the actual long-term ability of communities who historically have not had good access to the internet to have better access in the future. So, the argument to make this a public utility is that cities benefit when its residents are doing well, when they're healthy, when they're productive, and when they are able to build future opportunity. So cities are incentivized to make internet work well within their cities for everyone within their cities. And that's just a very, very different incentive than shareholders.
Sure, sure. When we come back, we are going to continue this conversation with Karen Landman about internet access, how crucial it has been over the last 2 years during the pandemic, how crucial it is to our lives in general, and whether we ought to be really focusing on making sure that everybody, regardless of income or where you live, has that kind of broadband internet access. We want to get going on the phones as well. Give us a call, 313-577-1019. Tell us what you think is so critical about internet access. What role is it playing in your life? What role did it play over the last 2 years? How different is your life right now interacting over broadband than it was just before the pandemic? Also, give us a sense of whether you think we ought to be treating this as a public good, making sure that everybody has access to it. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. We'll get to John on the east side first. If you want to join him, give us a call or go to social media, put comments there. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
Bringing you news that matters.
Stories that impact your life.
Music from the Motor City and around the world.
This is 101.9 WDET,
Detroit's NPR station.
You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, I'm really glad that you've joined us. Our guest is Karen Landman. She is a physician, an epidemiologist, and a journalist who covers health and medicine for Vox. And she's written a recent piece titled "The Surprising Link Between COVID-19 Deaths and Internet Access: The Case for Treating Internet Access as a Health Necessity." We're talking about how crucial internet access seems in our lives right now, especially after the 2 years of the pandemic, which required us to kind of stay away from each other, but still be able to conduct business and interact socially. It was the internet that made all of those things possible over the last 2 years. The question now, I think, is how crucial internet access is to our lives and whether we ought to be doing more to make sure that everybody has it. There is, of course, a great technology gap that exists between those of us with means and people who don't have enough money to have access, or who live in places that have not invested in the infrastructure to be able to connect people to the internet. We want to hear from you again on the phones, as always. 313-577-1019 is the number. Call and tell us how crucial internet access is in your life, how the pandemic maybe changed how crucial internet access is and how you're using it now, how that looks different than it did maybe two and a half years ago. You can also go to social media, of course, and put comments there, and we'll include you in the conversation that way. We're going to start today with John on the East Side. John, welcome to the show.
Well, this is a conversation, I'll tell you. You know, you look at the record of the DTE and providing us energy, and you say, well, is this where we want to go? And Internet, I'm becoming more and more reliant on it. I listen to DET on the Internet quite a bit now during the day. And I see just what the problems are, because right in the middle of a really interesting conversation, it cuts out. And it's a huge problem. But I just don't know that we, you know, I don't know what we are. Are we a capitalist society or what? Why do we have the different commissions that control our utilities? We used to have a commission that controlled the liquor, the prices of liquor and everything. And I don't know that this is a good idea.
Mm. So John, what would you prefer? How would you prefer that be managed?
I don't have the answers, but I just don't see that another federal agency is the way to go, unless they can significantly increase their reliability.
John, great points, and I don't have the answer either, but I think you're not wrong to point out the insufficiency of the way that we regulate other utilities. There's a similar comment on social media from Anthony on Twitter. Says guests keep talking about, quote, public utilities, but I can't think of many around here. There is an issue, Karen, with the way that we deal with water and electricity and other things that people need now that cuts a lot of people off. I think maybe people are skeptical that treating internet access the same way will expand the footprint. In other words, make sure that more people have access.
Yeah, I hear that. You know, if you have a broken government at a local level, then any additional responsibility you give them, you have a lot of doubt whether that would be done well and done equitably. So I completely hear that, you know, and I don't have a solution for that other than to have as big a voice as you can in how your local government works and vote. I will say that, there are a lot of these municipal community networks in the United States. There are hundreds, mostly in smaller towns. I think that's, part of it is it's a little bit easier to mobilize in smaller places because perhaps there's not as much pushback from the big for-profit companies. And it's just generally easier to make things happen in a smaller town where there are fewer voices and perhaps a more functional city government because there's a greater sense of, community responsibility. But there are several in Michigan right now, not in Detroit, but there's one in, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, Sebewing, and another in Marshall. And I wonder, for folks who really are serious or seriously interested in seeing a change like this in their communities, I wonder if it might be worth, talking to the folks who are involved in that or who get services through these networks. That would be one way to hear the pluses and minuses and the places where it has succeeded and the vulnerabilities. Where I'm from, we have some similar problems with public utilities and they're not perfect. So I think, sometimes you try to take a step towards something different and it ends up being a step forward, and sometimes it ends up being a step back. And getting as much information in advance about where the challenges might be can help push it in a more positive direction. But I completely understand the lack of trust in some of these organizations and and the concerns.
Yeah. Again, John, really appreciate the call and the comments. Let's go to Matthew in Livonia. Matthew, what's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call, Stephen. I'm a filmmaker, and I've been working with a national nonprofit called Connect Nation on this exact topic. We've been sent into over a dozen communities in Michigan and other states as well to interview leaders in the community and also just people, homeowners, farm owners, about their thoughts on this particular topic. And one thing that always stood out to me, especially from the old-time farmers, were that they almost look at this as it's the same issue when they first got power to the farm, that they were the last ones to get power out to these rural communities and how much of an impact it finally made on them. And they kind of look at it in that same way, that they're these younger communities, these younger farmers don't want to stick around if they don't have access to the internet. They can't get people to stay in the area and the younger people to commit to being farmers when they don't have access to the outside world.
Wow. Wow. That's such an interesting experience, Matthew. Tell me a little more about this idea of going to these places and trying to get people internet access.
It was quite the experience. You know, I'll talk about my Northern Michigan, for example, experiences. We got to go out and interview, you know, leaders of communities of, municipalities and people out there. And every one of them said the same thing, that without internet, these communities have no future in the modern world. And they've kind of been pushed off to the side simply because it's expensive to get it out there. Mm-hmm. My task was to help these communities build their case as part of Connected Nations' task to then present it to the federal government in hopes that they'll be awarded grants and help get some funding to get internet out to these
to
areas.
To build this infrastructure.
What's the infrastructure? What would be the best approach for them? Would it be cabling or would it be, say, a Wi-Fi solution for them, right? And help them understand what infrastructure is in place already. And it is exceptionally lacking. You know, I actually got to follow around people who were documenting infrastructure, and everywhere is lacking in those rural areas. There's just there's no investment in it.
Yeah. Matthew, I'm really glad you called and shared that experience. Karen, one of the things that jumps out at me from Matthew's call is this link between rural and urban. The problems are different, right? In rural communities, I think you're really talking about infrastructure as the main barrier to internet access. But that looks, in practical terms, like what we see in places like Detroit and neighborhoods where people don't have enough money to connect to broadband all the time. We think of them as different problems, I think, but maybe part of the solution is thinking of it all more globally and making that connection. You know, when Matthew talked about not being able to keep people in rural communities because there isn't broadband, it reminded me of the way in which people leave cities like Detroit, right? When they grow up and get an opportunity, they don't want to stay because the things that they want aren't here. That's a mirror. It's not a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear that. That was a very powerful point of view that Matthew shared. So I'm also glad that he shared it. And yeah, I think, you know, a lot of young folks really want to participate in life online in a meaningful way, not just consuming things, but being part of conversations on social media and using the internet to learn and work. And it's really, if you cannot do that where you live, the natural choice for a lot of folks is to relocate to a place where you can do that. And that is draining a lot of the best folks from our rural our rural communities. And that is a darn shame because there's so much wonderful stuff in those parts of the country and in those parts of Michigan, I'm sure. The good news is that in the infrastructure bill passed last year, there were $65 billion allocated to solving some of our broadband issues nationwide. And about two-thirds of that, about $42 billion, is earmarked for building infrastructure in rural communities to support internet access. So that is a move in a positive direction for these communities to have better access. But, you know, there's still, you know, you can still be in an urban community and not have great internet access. And, you know, the subsidies that this bill provides for in urban areas and the, you know, the little bit of infrastructure that will probably grow in urban areas as a consequence of this bill probably is not enough to really make a big turnaround in urban areas for people who have internet access issues there as a consequence of affordability. And so I think, you know, you'll see the same dynamic, people really frustrated by not being able to get what they need in order to participate in conversations, in order to grow and learn, and feeling really frustrated by that, but perhaps also because of affordability, unable to relocate. So yeah, this bill will solve some problems, but certainly not all of them.
Yeah. Okay. Karen Landman, it was really great to have you here to have this discussion. Congratulations on the piece, and thanks so much for joining us on Detroit Today.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It was a real pleasure to be on and to speak with you and with some of your listeners.
When we come back, Chad Livengood of Cranes Detroit Business is going to join us to talk about funding for an old infrastructure project here in Michigan, the roads, all the money that we decided to spend a few years ago in order to make the roads a little better. I don't know if you've noticed, I have. They aren't much better. Why is that so, and what do we still need to be doing? We'll find out next when we get back with more Detroit Today.